Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish. Andrew Hunter-Murray is away on holiday looking for rare species of moss, or perhaps covering his entire house in solar panels. I'm not sure what he's doing, but he's not here. And so in his place, we have the founder of QI, John Lloyd. Now, you'll all know John because he's been on this show many, many times. But if you're a new listener, then he's like a master of British comedy over the last 40, 50 years. He was instrumental in things like Not the 9 o'clock News, Blackadder, QI, of course, Spitting Image. If you were a fan of that back in the day, there's a really nice anecdote later on in this episode where he talks about that. Basically, he's an all-round genius, and I'm sure you'll enjoy his talents on this week's show. I should quickly say, because I know he would want me to, that his son, Harry, who is a good friend of all of us, he is in a band and they have a new single out. The band is called Waiting for Smith. So if you're interested in that, then go to anywhere where you get your music or any bit of social media, search for Waiting for Smith and you will find all about that. Anyway, without further ado, let us continue with another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish with Mr. John Lloyd. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with James Harkin, Anna Tashinsky, and John Lloyd. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Lloydy.
So my fact is that Picasso inhaled his first cigar on the day he was born. So Picasso was born at home on the 25th of October 1881. He had a very difficult birth and he was unusually small and undeveloped. The midwife wrote him off as stillborn.
Oh no.
Right.
And literally parked him on a side table while she looked after his mum.
Right.
And it was fortunate because Picasso's uncle, his father's brother, Salvador Ruiz Blasco, who was also a doctor, happened to be there, and he was smoking a cigar, as you do in those days.
Of course, yep.
And he strode over and puffed a great waft of smoke into Picasso's face, and the baby went, ah!
Oh, really?
In a horrible face.
Okay.
And let out a huge yell and saved his life.
Wow.
Okay.
So he didn't enjoy his first smoke, like many of us, it sounds like. He didn't embrace it first time round.
Well, he came round quickly because he was a lifelong smoker. Mm-hmm. In fact, he smoked until 7 years before his death, age 91. Mm. But tellingly, he never inhaled.
Is that right?
So there you are.
The Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
he died in 1973.
Yeah.
Which I worked out meant that he could, in theory, have met Pharrell Williams, the pop star.
Okay.
And do you think they would have got along?
Well, Pharrell was only 3 days old when Picasso died. And for all that time, Pharrell was in Virginia and Picasso was in France. So at least one of them would have had to make quite a lengthy trip.
Yes.
Or a Zoom call.
A Zoom call, yeah.
What are you thinking we're missing out on by them not meeting? Why them two specifically?
Well, I just think Pharrell is a very, very modern day name, right?
Right.
And Picasso, for anyone who was born after he died, like myself, he feels like someone in the past.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So I think it's quite surprising that those two could, in theory, have met.
Of course, Virginia, the home of tobacco, Virginia ready rubbed and so on.
It
would have
point.
Got on really well.
Yes. he was baptized Pablo Diego, Jose Francisco de Paula, Juan Nepomuceno, Crispiniano, Maria de los Remedios, de la Santissima Trinidad Rui Picasso.
Mm. Actually not. Because the priest made...
Well, you could have said that before I started, John.
The priest made a spelling mistake.
Oh, did he?
He was supposed to be called Crispiniano because St. Crispin's Day,
yeah.
The 25th of October, was the day he was born. And the priest made a spelling mistake and called him Cipriano.
Right. Cipriano, oh, really? Which is a brand of crisps, isn't it?
His first word, there's a legend behind that, that his mother says, which is that it was pencil. So he sort of seems like a child of destiny in a way.
Okay.
Piz.
I'm not allowed to do the accent on the show anymore, John. No. So okay. I just pronounce the English version.
Is that slang for penis in Spanish as well? I think it might be.
Is it?
Well, pencil means little penis, doesn't it? Penicillus.
Yeah. We'll never know which he was referring to at the age of 1.5.
They both could have been quite prescient, couldn't they?
They were sort of his two leading tools, I would say, weren't they? We should say, for anyone who's already switched off because we're talking about Picasso, his reputation has taken a bit of a dive, hasn't it, the last 10 years. I hadn't quite realised how much his mistresses were in basically all of his art. So it was sort of all about his sex life and his shagging. And a lot of people do criticise the way that he exploited women. And, you know, people say women were tools to be exploited for his art. And he did once say, every time I change wives, I should burn the last one so that, you know, you can wipe the slate
clean. The
last wife
or the last painting?
The last wife.
The last wife.
Okay.
Yeah. He only actually married twice, but I think he's referring to all his mistresses all his then. Mistresses.
Two types of women, he said, goddesses and doormats.
One of his early lovers, Françoise Gillot, is part of one of my favourite facts, which is that she later married Jonas Salk, who developed the polio jab.
Oh, that's a good fact.
Yeah.
Isn't it? So she was basically Picasso's muse, and then she married this guy who saved the world a little bit, really, because so many people were dying of polio in those days. But people asked her later why she was attracted to such outstanding men. And she replied, I think I am just as interesting as they. Lions mate with lions. They don't mate with mice.
That's very good. I think, wasn't she the only muse who left him?
Yes. She was immune to his charms. She's such a... she's a nice person to read about after, I suppose, all these women who ended up, according to some accounts, destroyed. She just said, he didn't know me very well at all. I'm very secretive. I smile politely, but I don't agree. And I didn't invest my narcissism in being represented by him. I couldn't care less.
Yeah.
And walked off.
She wrote a book about him, a very famous book, Life with Picasso. I actually read it when I was like 15 years old, saw it in a library. It's an amazing book. And it basically caused a lot of problems when it came out because no one wanted to know this side about Picasso. When it was released, there were 40 intellectuals who signed a petition to have it banned and scrapped and pulped. And
were there intellectuals? Yeah. They thought his reputation will...
Yeah, including one of the major biographers who wrote numerous volumes on Picasso's life afterwards, saying that this should be in like a tabloid as opposed to
is
a bookshop.
Is that John Richardson?
Yeah, John Richardson.
From 8 out of 10 Cats
Countdown. Yeah, he was fuming. He was furious. But interestingly, she was asked about this in her 90s about this biography, and she said all these men who wrote that had never met me, didn't know what I was talking about, and she and John Richardson became really good friends despite him slagging it
off.
How
interesting.
And you will see her on Countdown, Cats 2 Countdown.
She's... when Rachel Riley's off for maternity.
Yeah, Francis Boss.
Richardson argued that his art was almost parodying the machismo of Andalusian males rather than him actually being like that. Which I don't believe.
It's very...
It's a really interesting thing. This, I always believe that when you're at work, if you're going to do it well, you mustn't have an ego. And I used to say for years and years, you know, Picasso famously didn't behave terribly well in all sorts of ways. But I'm guessing that when he went in front of the easel, that all went away. Hmm. And years later, I found this wonderful quote saying, when I enter my studio, I leave my personality outside the door as a Muslim leaves his slippers outside the mosque.
Mm. He did spend a lot of time at the easel, though, didn't he? Like, it's hard to find the exact number of works that he did, but it was a lot.
It's insane.
147,800, but that's not exact. It's...
that's according to
give
like,
or take one
the,
or two
the official website. Yeah, yeah, they've done counting up, and they and we've lost a lot of it because in his early days he used to burn his bits of art to keep his fire going.
Yes. So
along with his wives, yeah, they tossed them all on the bonfire.
I worked out that that's one work of art for every 5 hours, 25 minutes of his life. If he started as a baby. Right. And carried on going until he met Pharrell that time.
Which once you've had your first smoke, you might as well pick up a paintbrush. Yeah. He also was responsible for a major art theft, which I hadn't realised because we'd mentioned before on the show that he was accused of stealing the Mona Lisa.
He was interviewed by the police, right?
Yeah. Yes.
He was, yes.
Because Apollinaire, his friend, shopped him to the police.
Yes.
And Picasso then went to court and denied he'd ever met him, even though he's one of his best friends.
It's quite a low moment, isn't it? Yeah. In their friendship, in their moral lives.
That's probably the best indication of the power that Picasso had, that he thought he could Jedi his way through.
Like, the thing was, when he described the person who actually stole it, the police did a sketch and the nose was on this side of his face and the eyes were on the side.
But there's more to it, Anna, isn't there?
Well, there is more to it, yes, because, so that was 1911, but actually in 1907, there were these two Iberian statues stolen from the Louvre. And I think there's just been a book written which puts all the pieces together. But Picasso had first spotted them in about 1904, fallen in love with them, told all his mates, I love these statues. They were put in storage. Then they disappeared. Turned out they'd been stolen by this chap called Pierret. And he was mates with Picasso and the dodgy Apollinaire.
He was Apollinaire's secretary, I think.
He was Apollinaire's secretary, yes. But it turned, basically, Picasso's lover at the time, Fernand Olivier, said that he had lots of artworks around his house, and then he had these two statue heads under some clothes in his wardrobe. And she asked him about them once, and he said, oh, we shouldn't display them anywhere too prominent. And it turned out to be these two stolen statues the Louvre. And we assume that Pierre had given them to Picasso. Maybe Picasso had asked him to steal them. Some people say that Pierre couldn't have carried them both out under his coat, which is what he claimed. So maybe Picasso was there.
It's a lot easier to steal stuff from the Louvre in those days, wasn't it?
I was a piece of piss, yeah.
They
had lousy security, didn't they?
Yeah. I think there was a story that Pierre once said to his girlfriend, I'm going to the Louvre today. Do you want me to pick anything up for you?
And then ironically, Picasso's the most stolen artist in history now.
Yes.
But I think it's largely because he made so much. Right.
You can't help stealing one. Like, you pick up a sketch.
Yeah, and Apollinaire's secretary had something to do with it, I'm sure. Shifting his stuff back to...
Yeah.
So even when he was in his 70s and 80s, he was quite a womanizer, Picasso. Mm. And whenever anyone came to his house who he fancied, he would make a little sculpture of a little man with an enormous phallus and then give it to them as like a love gift.
Right.
And
Did that work a high percentage of the time?
It didn't work so often because he quite often did it in front of his wife. And anyone who'd been given this like phallic item was not allowed back in the house.
Right.
Because his wife would just be like, well, you're obviously not coming back.
Yeah.
And again, this is according to John Richardson.
One ought to say, you know, given all these sort of anecdotal things and the naughtiness, that he was an extraordinary painter. And those two statues you mentioned inspired him for Les Demoiselles d'Avignon.
Yeah, which is a great painting.
Is described by John Golding, the art critic, as the greatest painting of the 20th century. Yeah, really. So influential.
It's kind of cool for him to take, like, looking back at it now, if the ends justify the means, it's fine that he stole those things if they inspired those great works.
Yeah, and no one gave a shit about two random Iberian statues from 2,000 years ago in storage.
Remind me to not have James as my lawyer.
We were going to do a fact about them in the podcast the next week.
He used to make some of his paints as well. There's a particular brown that he made, which we only now know what the secret sauce was.
HP?
To it. no, not quite. It was his 3-year-old daughter's poo.
Oh,
come on, Dan.
Yes.
No.
Poo Casso.
Surely
they
not.
Called
no.
The article. Yeah. He used to say that the best feces as well would be from a mother who the infant was being breastfed.
Well, I would say that, like, this is a 3-year-old child, right?
Yeah.
But definitely the poo of a much younger baby is a colour that you can't really see anywhere else in the world.
Oh,
right?
True, yes.
I never seen a felt tip the same colour as a nappy from a 2-month-old.
Well,
but
you've seen my
yellow
tie, though. It's very, very similar.
For listeners, John is wearing a tie which is like 50 shades of feces.
Come on. The nice orangey baby feces.
Yeah.
The harmless kind.
He also, I mean, we're talking about his paintings, but he predicted in his own lifetime that he would be more known for his poetry than his paintings.
Picasso?
Yeah, after his death.
Did he? What an idiot.
He wrote over 300 poems, and he also wrote 2 surrealist plays.
He can't really have believed he was, because he was incredibly famous for his paintings throughout his life. And no one was going, do you know what, Picasso? People should make more of your poems. Did he really think?
Well, he probably thought they'll forget about it one day and my poems will live on after me.
I think this is a common theme with artists, though. You know, rock bands who always pick the wrong song is going to be successful and hate the one that's famous.
Yeah.
Like John Richardson is always, they're asking him in interviews about 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown and they never ask him about his Picasso biographies today.
But that, like that Arthur Conan Doyle quote you must have touched before, that if in 100 years I'm remembered just for Sherlock Holmes, I would have considered my life a failure.
Yeah. Sorry, mate. Embrace it.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hey, everyone. This week's episode of Fish is sponsored by Saley.
Yes. Have you ever been to a different country? Probably. If you have you ever wanted to use the internet there? Of course. Have you ever not been able to? I've been in this situation so many times, and Saley is the answer. It's so clever. It's an eSIM. You only need to install it once, and as soon as you've installed it, you get access to SIM plans for over 190 countries. Now, there are 193 countries that are members of the UN. So I think they're basically covering all the countries.
Yeah, it is really amazing. Roaming charges, the bane of my life, Anna. They've dogged me wherever I've gone, and that has now changed. It means you can avoid scams as well, because quite often people will be selling local SIM cards in the country, and they'll be fake, and you can get scammed from them. And it changes so many different things. I mean, the convenience of being able to just download it once on your phone, and it's applied to all of those different countries.
Yes, it's really easy to use. You just download the app and it's compatible with iOS or Android devices. And then you follow the instructions on the app to install the eSIM, and basically Bob's your uncle. And you can get an exclusive 15% discount on your Saley eSIM data plan if you download the app and use the code FISH at checkout.
That's right. Do it now. Okay, on with the podcast.
On with the show.
Okay, it is time for fact number 2, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that the national song of St. Helena was written by a man who had never been there. He based his lyrics on a postcard that he had seen.
Incredible. Let's hear it.
God save our great... No. That is the national anthem of St. Helena because it's a British territory.
So did he base it on the stamp of the postcard?
He wrote another anthem called My St. Helena Island. And it's kind of the de facto anthem. It's not the official national anthem, but it's the one that all saints, as they're known as, in St. Helena would sing. And it was written by an American who is better known for his appearances on 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown called David Mitchell.
Stunning.
David Mitchell, he was nicknamed Old Saddlebags, and he was a DJ on Ascension Island, which is... I was going to say nearby. It's not nearby, but it's the nearest place to St. Helena, because St. Helena's in the middle of the ocean. He became friends with some people from St. Helena, and they suggested that he writes a song for them. And he was a bit reluctant to do that because he'd never been there, but they sent him some postcards and he wrote this song. And that's what happened. It goes, my heart is drifting southwards to my home down in the sea, to the Isle of St. Helena, where my loved ones wait for me. We're having a lovely time. Weather is changeable. Food is awful. Wish you were here.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, genius.
It's really good. And he recorded them officially, the songs, and they made records of it. And he sent a bunch of records and pictures of himself to St. Helena as part of, like, here's the merch that you can have. But he's not really known anywhere, even in his hometown in Memphis. Mm. But yeah, he's someone who's still around. Yeah. I mean, it's not that long ago, right? So
I think he's dead, isn't he?
Do you?
He?
Oh, okay. The site
I saw. His family... He's recently dead, I think.
Right, okay.
But I might be wrong about that. So
but nobody's blown cigar smoke in his face yet, so you can't tell. It's interesting in postcards because both Matisse and Picasso used postcards to inspire some of their greatest work.
Did you know?
So Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, for example, was based on a postcard that Picasso found. Yeah,
I did not know that.
Yeah.
And did you know that it's not the only national anthem or national song, because it's not strictly a national anthem, that was written by somebody who'd never been there? Did you
Go
know
on.
That? Guinea-Bissau on the west coast of Africa. Oh, yeah, the music was written by a Chinese guy called Xiao He, because the words were written by a separatist leader of the African party called Amilcar Cabral, who was the leader of the African Party for the Independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde.
Wow.
And in 1963, he went on a delegation to China and they met this guy, Zhao He, and asked him to write the music.
Really? Amazing.
Yeah, literally last year in 2024, Xi Jinping held a welcome ceremony for the current president of Guinea-Bissau, who's a guy called Umaro Sissoko Embalo, and they played the anthem. This
That's
is
really
our well-beloved motherland.
It feels like it's got an edge to it when you're being hosted by Xi Jinping as the president of tiny Guinea-Bissau, and he's saying, here's your national anthem, we wrote it, by the way. Don't forget it.
Well, if anyone doesn't know where St. Helena is, basically, from Guinea-Bissau, head west, and it's pretty much the first place you get to. It's like a tiny island in the middle of the Atlantic.
It's so isolated when you look on a map. If you go on your Google Maps or whatever on your phone, it is insanely isolated. Yeah,
we cannot find a way of getting there. You'll get a lot when you try direction.
Exactly. And there's a lot of, I watched a few tourist videos for it where they said, you can achieve all you need to see in a single day, but why not stay for three? It's just such
because that's when the next boat leaves.
Yeah, possibly, right? Yeah.
I should just say thanks to my sister-in-law's best friend who gave me a lot of information about St. Helena because she lives there.
Oh.
The national dish of St. Helena is tomato paste sandwiches. They're called bread and dance. And the idea is that if you're at a wedding, there'll be a big sort of table with a load of goodies on and everyone will dance around it and then you'll eat something from the table.
Mm.
And it's usually some bread. And
dipped
some
in tomato tapenade.
Sauce. Yeah, pretty much.
Right.
Because it's really hard to get hold of fresh stuff there. Basically, once a month, you get a boat that comes in with fresh fruit and vegetables and everyone legs it to the shop. Six pack of Watsits, which is £2 at Poundland in the UK, is £4 on St. Helena. And a box of cornflakes that's £2.85 in the UK is £7 in St. Helena.
But there's not that much else to spend your money on, so yeah, you're not complaining.
No, there's not a lot going on. But two very famous residents, as most people, if they think of St. Helena, Napoleon being exiled there after Waterloo in 1815.
Mm-hmm.
And the other famous resident, you know who that is?
No.
Jonathan the Giant Tortoise.
Oh, yeah.
Who lives in the grounds of the governor's official residence, and he's 192.
Jonathan's still alive?
Yeah.
Still going. Pretty amazing. Yeah.
He was 5 when Queen Victoria was crowned.
Probably he's died quite a few times and they've just replaced him with another tortoise.
No. He's...
Like SEO Trot.
Yeah.
He's not. He's terribly well. I've got a quote about him.
From him?
Yeah. No, it's from his vet.
Said cowabunga, dude.
It's from his vet. Jonathan is now blind, but he still has a tremendous libido.
No, sorry, that's your Picasso notes. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It kind of started off with the East India Company, who were doing lots of trade with the East and with Europe, and they needed somewhere to stop on the way because there was no Suez Canal in those days. So you'd go all the way around Africa, and they would always call it St. Helena on the way. And eventually they decided to put a colony down there. And the first laws included God was to be worshipped and served diligently. And seamen were not allowed to stay on the island without permission.
Oh, really?
If you were caught harbouring a sailor, you'd be fined £5.
What's wrong with sailors? Should be inviting people, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think they just didn't want anyone coming on the island who wasn't supposed to be there.
Right. Okay.
Given it was only sailors who were going by.
Yeah. Yeah, who else are you going to get? Swimmers?
Yeah.
Do you know what the postcode is on St. Helena?
No, that's good. What?
It's STHL1ZZ. The point being, it's a Royal Mail postcode. And it had its own postcode, I think. But apparently people kept writing to St. Helena and mail kept going to St. Helens in Merseyside, which is quite a long way. To go from there.
That's brilliant.
Hard to know what to do with that mail when it drops through your doorstep. So they gave him a Royal Mail postcode.
Because that was the only way you could really get there for a very long time, which was the RMS St. Helena. And it was the Royal Mail ship that would bring all the post over. So you would sort of jump onto that in order to get over.
And someone tried to post themselves out of St. Helena, actually, didn't
they?
Yes. So another thing that it was used for by the Brits was in the Boer War, 1900 to 1902, they sent 6,000 Boer prisoners of war to this tiny place. God knows how they suddenly accommodated them. And there was one prisoner of war called Andreas Smorenberg who made this crate and he wrote on it, "Curios only" inside here. And then he climbed in and he got the crate put in a place where it was going to be picked up by a passing mail ship, put a fake address on in London, filled it with like clothes and matches and water, and bedded down for the 20-day journey. And wow. Sadly, even though the source said, even though he marked it with care and this side up, it was tossed around quite badly, and he was very severely concussed. And then when they landed at Ascension Island, they got out sort of an unconscious, damaged man and sent him straight back to St. Helena.
Oh, so he didn't die? No. Okay.
He didn't die, no. But
they left him in someone's bin area for a few days.
So St. Helena and the RMS St. Helena, the boat that you used to get there on, both, of course, named after the actual St. Helena, which I'm sure you knew, the mother of the Emperor Constantine, and also a saint, famous for discovering parts of the True Cross, which she excavated from the Holy Land when she was visiting there. Yeah. She excavated three crosses, actually, but she knew she'd got the real one when it created a miracle by curing a sick woman who touched it. Okay. But not only that, she also discovered the true nails that were holding the cross, Jesus onto the cross.
Right. And the parts true hammer that was used to bang the nails in.
No, that isn't mentioned in my research. But the nails were there, and also uniquely, the holy rope that Jesus was tied to the cross with, which is unique. It's the only relic of the holy rope.
How interesting, because I was taught at school that he was nailed and that the other
were tied
thieves
on,
were tied and he wasn't tied.
It could have been one of the thieves.
I mean, it's all made up, isn't it?
But, well, we don't know where she was born. That's the thing. And there's an old British legend that she was a British princess. Did you know that?
Yeah.
The daughter of old King Cole of Colchester.
A very old soul fame.
Yes. Yeah. And Colchester is on its coat of arms, it has the three nails that she discovered.
Really?
Wow.
That's very cool. Well, this is interesting. So where do you think the second largest collection of St. Helenians?
Saints
is what they're called.
Well, I'm going to say St. Helens, I reckon, in
Merseyside. They got misdirected.
It's not. It's Swindon.
Is it?
No.
Swindolina, as it's known to the locals in Swindon.
That doesn't make any sense.
Like St. Helena. Swindolina.
There's about a fifth of what the current population in actual St. Helena is in Swindon. So there's like 800 people there.
What are they doing there?
Well, they were all given British nationalship in 2002 after the Falkland Wars. And so if you want to go meet locals from St. Helena, go to Swindon.
Cool.
Yeah.
Didn't John Richardson move to Swindon?
He did move there.
He moved there because he worked out that it had the best transport links in the whole of the UK.
Yeah, to get into London and to get to the gigs he needed to. That's right. God, he's more prolific than we've given him credit for, isn't he?
Are we trying to get him on this show? What's going on here?
Okay, it's time for fact number three, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that to go into the BBC's sound department in Maida Vale, you have to walk down a set of steps that are each one-third concrete, one-third carpet, and one-third wood. This is amazing. I saw this fact, I should say, when I was just scrolling through Facebook earlier this year, and Tony Way, who I'm friends with, he's a movie star. He's in The Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise movie.
All right, clang.
Yeah, he's also in a lot of British sitcoms, Black Books, and I mean anything you can think of, Afterlife with Ricky Gervais, he's part of it. He's a great actor. He was there, and he took a photo of it and showed it, and it's pretty amazing. So when I say that the staircase is a third of each,
it's like you've got a runner down the middle, but either side is different.
That's a very good way of putting it. So this is where the BBC do their Foley, which is the sound effects, the extra noises that go into TV, radio and movies. And they have a whole bottom floor there, which is pretty extraordinary when you get a walk through it. So I watched a video of Sean Keaveney doing it, the radio.
Another friend of yours, is he, Dan?
Actually is. So they have a kitchen that's set up, and it's all mic'd up. And so you can make tea and you can slam cupboards and you can move bottles. So anytime they need that, that's all done there. They have a room where it's just full of seaweed and sand and little mats that you can walk on that can create the sound of the ocean, the forest with the magnetic tapes, or compressed snow when you throw the mat on top of sand.
Seaweed.
Yeah. Okay. I mean,
is the seaweed making?
Yeah.
Is that just
That's a really good point. It must be artificial. It looked exactly like seaweed in the...
Is it seaweed inside the water?
No, this is just on the floor.
That seaweed would just dry out in about...
Well, they've probably got a seaweed person who worked the intern's job first
days. It wouldn't have been seaweed. When I worked in radio, when I started, we used to use quarter-inch tape, recording tape, for lots of effects, like walking through grass.
Yeah. Mm.
You'd rustle that.
Well, that's what they had there, yeah. All this tape that was in piles. And I messaged Tony to say, is there anything else that you saw there? And he said there's also a Foley coat. So it's made of different fabrics. It's a coat you put on, made of different fabrics with different kind of zips and fastenings attached to replicate any kind of clothing sound that you want, but all in one coat. Which is
that looks
amazing.
Like it would be a really cool coat.
No, Anna, how often have you been getting off a train and you're like, I need my ticket, and you've only got five pockets, but you've no idea which pocket it's in.
And you're making a mad array of noises. Honk! Sorry, guys.
So I wonder if that Foley coat was used. There's a very famous story about Mrs. Dale's diary, which was the sort of forerunner of the Archers way back when.
Okay.
They were trying to get the sound of somebody opening a parcel. Mrs. Dale was delivered a parcel. They tried paper, didn't sound anything like it, because famously in sound effects, often you think of a helicopter, sounds like shoo, 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 which we used to make using what's called a double ender, which is a wire with two brass plugs on the end.
Right.
It sounds like a helicopter, because what a helicopter actually sounds like is not like what you think a helicopter is supposed to sound like.
No, it's just very, very loud hum.
It's a loud, loud engine, yeah.
You can't really hear what you're saying, yeah.
So anyway, somebody undid their zip as an experiment. And so the priest said, what's that? That's an amazing sound. That's perfect parcel opening. So in the script it comes... Mrs. Dale, oh, hello there. Oh, what have you got in there? She said.
Okay, I'm seeing where the double ender name came from. Yeah. I really hadn't quite realised that what being a Foley artist entailed, and I think I want it as a job. It's so cool. Mm. If you're working in the films, basically they'll be sent the film and they'll come into a room and they've got all their props, and often they've collect. I think all Foley artists collect just like hundreds and hundreds of different props. Bring them in, lay them all out, and they've got a script which tells them vaguely what sounds to make. But then they watch the film, and live, they try to imitate what the person's doing. So you see them sort of jerking around, clutching at something quickly, stomp, stomp, stomp. They have to grab a shoe, reach for a cloth. It's amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing. And those items, like, if it makes the perfect sound, you just want to keep it forever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they get passed down from generation to generation. So... I was reading an interview with someone called Alison D. Moore, and her former partner in Foley had retired, and he gave her a copper towel bar with a koi fish on each end. And when you twisted it, it made a screech that sounded exactly like a startled cat. And he was like, this is my pride and joy. I take it everywhere I go, but you can have it now I've retired.
Wow.
So good. The BBC, I wonder, John, when you were saying that about the Foley sounds, was that live radio? The Foley was happening live along with it?
I did very little actual live radio. No, you just add the sound effects as you went along.
So,
although you were recording live, of course, and there's a famous... not famous to you, but to me, I used to do a radio show called The News Headlines with Roy Hudd. It was incredibly quick on the draw, a bit like a sort of Lee Mack of his day. It's very fast. And there was a sketch that involved a fridge. And in the script, the studio manager saw SFX door opens. And that's a standard BBC sound effect, because the rattle of the doorknob.
Yeah.
Like that. Mm-hmm. And so it said, Rory said, I'll just look in the fridge. And there was a... He said, a wooden fridge. It's a wonderful moment.
It is amazing. But it was a very strong thing with the BBC for live radio, particularly comedy shows like The Goon Show. And there was a famous incident where in the script, Neddy Seagoon, who was played by Harry Secombe, was to be hit by a sock full of custard. And they tried all these different sounds. They couldn't get it. And Spike Milligan got so frustrated during rehearsal that he took his sock off, he grabbed an assistant, sent them to the BBC canteen to fill it up with custard, which they did, brought it back, walloped Harry Secombe over the head with it, and it still didn't get the sound that they need. But that story got out, and the BBC got lots of complaints because this was in the last year of post-war rationing, and they said, you are wasting good custard.
Did they not drink it afterwards out of the sock?
Well, regardless of what they did,
that is wasteful.
Because they usually say on those programmes, don't worry, the food was shared amongst the crew afterwards.
Those bizarre sound effects. I remember I used to briefly produce a program called The Berkis Way, which was written by David Romick and Andrew Marshall. And they used to take great pleasure in writing sound effects that were impossible to do. And I remember one was SFX, Genghis Khan slices somebody's stomach off.
Oh, wow.
It's quite a while that took
what
to get
right.
What
did you do for that?
What did you do?
Well, I went to the canteen. I got a fresh stomach. It is interesting. It's one of those unsung things in movies and television, because without those little sounds, it doesn't have heft at all. Mm. When we did the first episode of Spitting Image, we decided not to have a laugh track because I don't know why. No time, I think. And it seemed completely boring because we used to make Spitting Image by recording the voice track first and then they puppeteers mime to it. And of course, they're made of rubber. So when a puppet, you know, touched the desk and it was a pre-recorded thing, nothing happened. Mm. So the two sound guys, absolute geniuses, stayed up literally all night doing all the, you know, touching the table, banging each other's heads, you know, scratching their clothes. And
I mean,
suddenly
it
comes
night.
Alive. It was an amazing thing because actually we owe the whole existence of Spitting Image to those two guys.
Yeah.
I was talking about this Foley artist called Alison D. Moore. I read an interview with her. It's really interesting. She said that there are more astronauts on Earth than people working in Foley at the moment.
What?
So I reckon that there's about 100 people doing Foley.
Really?
And there are more people who've been in space than that. She said that they can literally change the rating of a film by the sounds that they put in. So if there is, for instance, an oral sex scene,
yeah,
if they make it sound really filthy...
Oh,
then okay. Yeah, it can go up from a 15 to an 18.
But what's the is it just like like what?
That's normal oral sex. Yeah, that's how that sounds.
I think that downgrades it to like a U if you do that.
It is important to say that the Foley is a specific thing, which is something that's made on the spot, isn't it? Not like a recording.
Yeah.
That doesn't count as a Foley. So
you get lots of sound effects artists.
But I just wanted to give some people a hint of things, recordings that could be useful in other contexts. So, for example, the roar of a leopard sounds like someone roughly sawing wood.
Okay.
Which is useful.
Okay, good to know.
Bill Bailey said, without the beat in the background, jazz basically sounds like an armadillo was let loose on the keyboard. Okay. So if you wanted that sound...
It's amazing, though, because since BBC started recording their stuff and other massive production studios, there's these huge Foley archives that now exist, and a lot of them have been made available to the public. So the BBC have over 33,000 of its sound effects that are just on a website you can download and use as part of whatever you want to use. It's open to the public. Hanna-Barbera also is used a lot. So Hanna-Barbera that made the Flintstones and so on. Their sounds have been used in so many places you wouldn't expect. Multiple Mario Kart and Mario video games have the sounds that would have been used in the Flintstones that are sort of peppered all the way through.
Really?
Yeah. So
and they made those sounds by getting a pterodactyl to put their beak on a record player.
Yeah. But it's pretty wild. And we missed, I think it was the first 10 years of any kind of recording with BBC Radio. Until the arrival of a thing called the Blattner phone. It was only one machine that was recording all the radio output at the time that was coming from the BBC. And it wasn't a great recording necessarily, but the machine, the spools that would hold the tape were ginormous, and the tape would be traveling at really high speeds. So it would be traveling at 5 feet per second to record it, which was really dangerous for anyone who had to monitor the tape, because if it broke off, it would be like shrapnel shooting out the tape.
Wow.
And it was like a razor's edge. You would be cut to pieces if it shot.
What? Mm. Like a ninja.
Yeah. So it was incredibly
That's a great murder mystery. That should be a Jonathan Creek episode.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. And that would happen. It would be more dangerous because eventually they got two of these machines, the Blattner phone, which meant that they could change tape on one while recording on the other. So that was a seriously dangerous thing. They used to have to wear heavy gloves. And any time they were doing something that looked a bit delicate, they would run to the other side of the room in case it exploded on them.
Presumably when you change the tape, you stop it.
Yeah, but the thing can overheat. They had incidences, basically, where it just got too much.
It was the most dangerous job in the world, working for the BBC in the 50s.
It was.
And the 70s.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hello, everybody. This week, we're sponsored by Squarespace.
Yes, that's right. Squarespace. This is the all-in-one website platform that is designed to literally help anyone at any level create an amazing website for themselves or their business and have it all in one convenient spot.
That's right. Whatever you want to make a website for, I know right now I would be making a website to get a webcam constantly on the swan that's been sitting on 5 eggs for 6 weeks now to give me an alert when they hatch. Is that a thing you can do with a website?
That is a thing you could do. Absolutely. Not only that, Anna, you can create a little forum where people can discuss theories about when they're going to jump off. Oh. You can have t-shirts and pencils and mugs. You can sell it. You can have the whole swan experience in one spot through Squarespace.
God. Oh my God, I'm going to do it. www.swan.com.
I think that might be taken.
No. Anyway, yes, Squarespace does make it so easy to showcase your expertise or engage any visitors. You can make a stunning website if you go to squarespace.com/NSTAAF for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code NSTAAF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
That's right. So head there now, and I can't wait to hear all Swan updates. Okay, on with the podcast.
On with the show.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that every year, tens of thousands of people attend Rwanda's annual gorilla baby naming ceremony.
Aww.
Isn't it sweet? It is good.
Kwita,
it is sweet, yes. Oh, yeah, good. Yeah, nothing dark to it. Kwita Izina, which means to give a name in Kinyarwanda, which is the language. And this is so cool. It's this whole full week of activities devoted to gorillas, and it's all about their conservation and their protection because it's a huge deal in Rwanda. And the highlight is this naming ceremony where they've got a huge, really cool looking stage, which is a wicker sculpture of a gorilla, or a bamboo sculpture of a gorilla the size of a house. And then a celebrity and all researchers, or
who's the celebrity?
Lots of different celebrities. We'll get to the list. Wow.
Probably some of your mates.
John Richardson's gotta have a look at naming a gorilla.
John Keaveney goes there often, doesn't he?
Yeah. There are multiple characters who will come up on stage, and then they'll name one of the new baby gorillas that's been born that year, and a big picture comes up behind, and they say, "I name this gorilla," and they give them sensible. They don't call them sort of Barry.
quite a lot of Arsenal footballers go there because Arsenal are sponsored by Rwanda.
So they are, yes. Because the president's a big Arsenal fan, isn't he?
He is, yeah. So in 2018, Alex Scott went. In 2019, David Luiz went. In 2020, Hector Bellerin and Patrick-Emerick Aubameyang went. Aubameyang named a 14-year-old gorilla Ligitego, meaning goal. And Bellerin chose Mugariro, meaning defender. So it's like appropriate stuff for them. So Maybe next year they'll be runner-up or smashed by Paris Saint-Germain.
Boo.
do these poor gorillas have to wait sometimes nearly a year before they get a name?
Yes, I suppose they do. They probably have a holding name.
They might
have
their own name in their own language, and they might not care what we call them.
No.
I doubt it.
I don't know about gorillas, but did you know that marmosets are the only non-human primate that call each other by name?
Do they?
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Say, "Hello, Barry." I
and there's always Barry.
Always Barry.
So
they're all called Barry.
It's kind of pointless, really.
Yeah, of course, it may not be their name at all. It may be just a burp sound.
It's just a burp. Idris Elba they get big names.
Yeah.
Called one Narame, meaning long life. David Attenborough's obviously named one.
Yeah.
It sounds really fun. And the idea is to protect gorillas. And the story of protecting gorillas in Rwanda is an amazing success story, isn't it?
Diane Fossey.
Yep. Diane Fossey, yes, who I'm sure we'll talk about. It's estimated that one mountain gorilla, and it's mountain gorillas there, so there are four species and subspecies of gorilla, but one mountain gorilla can generate $3 million during its lifetime from tourism, and that all goes back into conservation, to protection, to the extent, and I found this really interesting, so there are, like I say, four species and subspecies of gorilla. There's Western Lowland, of which there are between 150 and 300,000. Remember that. There's Cross River gorillas, of which there are about 300. Mountain gorilla, I think they're about 800 to 1,000. And Grauer's gorilla, 6,500. All are critically endangered, except one, which is just endangered.
Right.
Now, have you memorized all the figures?
No.
Yeah, the lowland western gorillas, you said.
There you go. The western lowland, 150 to 300,000. Surely they're just endangered. No, they're critically endangered. And the mountain gorilla from Rwanda is the only one that's only endangered, even though there are only 800, because their numbers are going up.
Because they're going up. But that's I think that's how they do it, right?
No, of course it's how they do it. That's what they do. But I think it's an extraordinary discrepancy between 300,000, 800,
but
only one is critically endangered.
And it's kind of surprising that they're going up, well, certainly over the last 30 years or so, because they had a big old war in Rwanda, didn't they? And in actual fact, there were 16 gorillas killed during that civil war, but the population still...
This is a problem now. Gorillas or guerrillas? Guerrillas or gorillas?
I should check that, actually, that I'm not talking about guerrillas.
What do you call a gorilla with a machine gun?
I don't know, John.
Sir.
But yeah, basically, the gorillas moved up into the mountains away from all the humans and all the violence, and so that's why their numbers went way higher. And also, none of the factions wanted the bad publicity of killing gorillas.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they...
Although, and that is amazing, but the mostly the reason, because it is such a success story, is because Rwanda's run an extraordinary protection program.
Since then, which basically
means that they're...
How have they stopped the poaching? Is there a sort of security force?
There's just been an amazing investment in local communities. So a lot of the poachers, because people, I always think poachers get a bad rep. Largely they're poaching for survival, right? These were people in a country that was so poor. Mm. People were struggling. And the poachers are now involved in conservation. So there are a lot of poachers who do various tourist things now. And it's just giving them real national pride in this thing, like this big ceremony.
Well, that,
which means it literally doesn't happen.
Yeah, because they worked out, as you say, one gorilla can bring 3 million in an entire lifetime.
Yeah.
So it's more profitable now to be a tourist guide rather than to kill one and get a one-off payment.
Yes.
So it has largely come down from the stuff I've read to Diane Fossey. I mean, I know she's the ambassador name, but she really she moved there back in the 70s, plopped herself on the side of the mountain when there was virtually no one doing that. She was given a name, which was the woman who lives alone in the forest by all the locals.
Big ceremony, was it?
Yeah.
It was... Natalie Portman came along.
She had to wait a year before they thought of it.
But yeah, so Diane Fossey, the reason she went out there was this was off the back of a man called Lewis Leakey, who we've mentioned before, one of my favorite people in the world of paleoanthropology. Had wild theories and also had a lot of discoveries about ancient versions of Homo sapien and so on.
A few episodes ago, we had to fade you out when you started going into this kind of thing.
Well, he thinks that the reason that we became the dominant species on planet Earth is because we were too smelly to eat as we were in the wild. He's a brilliant guy. But he thought that the people who should go out and study apes should be a single woman with no scientific training. He's very much the Picasso of the paleoanthropology world in that he was a bit dubious with women. He had a lot of researchers around him who were, at his whim. He was a bit of deviant, but he did amazing things.
Did
in
you
the
say
field.
He was your favorite?
Do you know what? We can edit that bit, right? But he picked Diane Fossey. He thought she'd be perfect. And he said to her, the only thing that you need to have to go out there is no appendix. And so she took her appendix out to go. And
Someone else must have taken it out.
Well, yeah, a doctor took it out. And then she got a letter 6 weeks later from him saying, by the way, I was joking about the whole appendix thing.
No!
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it was too late. She already did it by then.
That's the problem with deadpan humour. If you don't put the emoji afterwards, people don't get it.
She's quite controversial, though, Diane Fossey, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I read that once she her associates captured a poacher, stripped him of his clothes, laid him spread eagle on the ground, and lashed his genitals with nettles.
She thought
basically the way that you deal with poachers is not, like Anna says, improving society and giving them other ways of making money. You should just beat it out of them.
Yeah.
I mean, that, to be fair, is kind of the twist in her story, is that she arrived as a conservationist. She learned so much about gorillas, wrote that incredible book. What's it called?
Gorillas in the Mist is a movie based on her.
Yeah,
right?
But that's off her book. So she wrote a book, which was a memoir of her time there. And then when poachers killed a gorilla that she'd really become close with, they lobbed the gorilla's head off.
Digit.
That's right. There was a turning point where she goes from conservationist really to poacher killer. And she was furious. And anyone who was in her way was part of the problem. So even the anti-poaching league, she thought, no, you're part of it as well. And to be fair, she had a horrific time in her early days there. She was kidnapped by rebels. She was sexually assaulted. She had a lot of bad times there.
Yeah, so she was tough as nails woman. I mean, bad childhood, tough times there.
Yeah.
Extraordinary person. But then she did go a little bit... Well, she just went hardline, didn't she, towards the end, and sort of beat up poachers, which is quite hardcore. And I actually had no idea that she was murdered, Diane Fossey, until researching this. Right. But
it's just such a wild story. So Digit was decapitated by the poachers and his hands cut off to make ashtrays out of. Mm.
And she was horribly murdered. She was found dead in her cabin and bizarrely blamed on a jealous fellow researcher in absentia, who I don't think was ever really solved, but I think we assume it was angry poachers.
Yeah, we still don't know. There's so many theories out there. And she's still there, though. She's buried in the gorilla cemetery.
Next to Digit. She's buried next to Digit.
Yeah.
Gorillas, though. Amazing animals.
They get high by spinning in circles. That's a new discovery.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that was, like, I really love this bit of science. Basically, there was a viral clip that went around of a gorilla spinning round, and they thought, oh, that looks fun, let's see if anyone else does that. And then they did more research and found out that they do that.
Well, if you will withhold drugs from the kids, they'll find a way. Won't they? They make like, you know how we make a big deal about lions and tigers roaring? I think the gorilla roar is the most frightening. So they do that, and then they make the belch sound, which is the other main kind of vocalization. And that's a little sort of like a little burp or a growl, which says, I'm here, don't worry, I'm your friend. And so if researchers are working with gorillas, then they learn to make that sound straight away to reassure them. Because you're in the jungle, you don't have that good visibility, so it's not as much about facial recognition. Although the other thing that researchers have to do is learn to memorize, and this is something that I think was pioneered a little bit by Diane Fossey, but learn to memorize their nose prints so that after a few months you can spot one 50 yards away and immediately know.
Well, that makes sense.
Barry.
Yeah, that's great.
Is it that obvious what the prints are, or do you have to get really close? Because like fingerprints, you need to put your fingers in ink, right?
It's definitely more obvious than that. It's like wrinkles on a face, on quite a wrinkly face.
Okay. Yeah. I noticed you were looking at me when you said that.
I was looking past you.
Do you know that when you arrive into Rwanda, they go through, like any airport security, you know, there's certain countries you can't bring fruit in and so on. Do you know what you're not allowed to bring in to Rwanda?
Drugs.
Not drugs.
Oh, you are allowed to bring drugs.
Well, no, it's just not the answer I'm looking for.
Okay. What's the answer you're looking for?
Plastic bags.
Ah.
If you go to their official tourism website, that's on there saying you will be stopped. And you can get in serious trouble if you're trying to smuggle plastic bags into the country.
12 months in prison for using plastic bags.
Wow.
Is it? You're joking.
100%. And the fine of up to $540. Now, that law is really in place for large companies who are breaking the law. Like, if you or I brought a plastic bag in, we probably wouldn't get 12 months in prison. But it is actually on the law books. That's the punishment.
Yeah, I remember that happening. We all thought, mad. Imagine living without plastic bags. And now we all sort of do. We don't, do we? That's a lie.
We just pay our 5p and suck it up.
I think, even though we've had all this talk of gorillas, the favourite animal in Rwanda is the cow. They're obsessively into cows. Okay. It's great. And so there's lots of dances inspired by cows. So you've got the kind of Rwandan ballet, which is inspired by cows, where women emulate cows' movements. Maybe they're more graceful in Rwanda.
Like, what does a cow do? It just stands there for ages and occasionally eats a bit of grass.
Gentle is what I read, and I actually didn't watch it. So gentle movements. It's a bit of swaying sometimes.
Swishing away
a tail.
Fly.
Yeah.
It's the tail. It's all in the tail.
It's very unique.
All Rwandan women have tails. Did I not mention
that? Oh, is that right?
Yeah. If you want to wish someone well, you say, may you have a cow or have thousands of cows.
Same in America. Don't have a cow, man.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Or St. Helena. Cowabunga, as the turtle says.
Yep. Okay. There's a lot of crossover. But they also love milk. And instead of going to a bar in Kigali, capital of Rwanda, you will go to a milk bar very often. And I think this is since the 90s, when after the genocide, there was massive urbanization and crops were decimated. A lot of the cattle were massacred and everything changed. And a lot of people missed that agricultural connection. And now they all go to milk bars.
Are they alcoholic milks?
No.
You can get that.
They are not.
Are they really?
That's what they claim. It might be that they're all getting pissed, but they're all claiming they just like a hot or a cold milk.
Right.
There's also a thing called the Gorinka program, which is the idea that the government will give every poor family a cow. And over the years, they've given over 400,000 cows to different families. And the idea is that You can use the manure to fertilize the land. You can help drink the milk. If you're not living in the city.
I was thinking, you're sitting there in your flat in the city, third floor with your cow in your lounge, and going, what the fuck are we going to do with this?
Do you think the naming ceremony is based on a sort of human? Because there are lots of those around the world, aren't there?
Yeah, it is.
It is. It's big in Rwanda. Giving the name that you give someone determines their life.
Yeah, they are born, they have their first cigar, and then you have a big ceremony where you name them and all of the family members come along and some people suggest different names and then they decide which one they're going to go with and there's a big old party.
And it's usually Idris Elba who it comes down to, the decision in the end. He's a very busy man, but...
But the ancient Romans had one called Dies Lustricus, or Purification Day. That was what the naming day was called.
That's cool.
According to Plutarch, until the baby had a name and the umbilical cord fell off, they were regarded as a plant rather than an animal.
Really?
Yes. It was only when the umbilical cord fell off.
And I suppose it's like a stalk.
Yeah, I guess you're rooted to something.
So this is a thing I didn't know. I knew that from somewhere that ancient Roman women had very small choice of names, but if you were called Claudius, for example, you had a daughter, she'd be called Claudia. She wouldn't have her own name.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a second daughter, she would be called Claudia Minor, and the first one would be called Claudia Major. If you had a third daughter, she would just be called Claudia Tertia, you know, Claudia the third until...
I think Julius Caesar had like four sisters all called Julia.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. In Hungary, there's a Hungarian naming day. Have you heard of this?
Mm-mm.
So the idea is that a name is associated with one day of the year and a lot of people will celebrate their name day rather than their
actual
birthday.
Oh, yeah, I think that happens in a few...
I think we've discussed that quite recently, haven't we? Often the saint day.
Oh, right.
It's
okay,
all like Ghana, where they name kids after the day of the week.
Yeah, right.
So in Akan, for example, Kofi, as in Kofi Annan, means born on Friday. And Kwasi, as in Kwasi Kwarteng, means born on Sunday.
Oh, really?
And Liz, as in Liz Truss, means born yesterday.
Hey!
Bit of three-year-old satire there.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. You can find us all on our various social media accounts. I'm on Instagram, at Schreiberland. James?
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
John, you're on Instagram, aren't you?
I'm John Lloyd QI.
Nice. And anything you want to plug while we're here?
Well, I really want to say my son, Harry, who you all know, is an amazing band called Waiting for Smith, and they've got a great new single coming out called I Got That Smiling For You, which I think is going to be his smash thing. Waiting for Smith on Instagram or all the other platforms.
Nice. And if you want to get to us as a group, Anna?
You can email podcast@qi.com or you can go to Instagram @nosuchthingasafish or tweet @nosuchthing.
Yep, or you can go to our website, nosuchthingasafish.com. You can find all of our previous episodes up there. There's links to some live shows that we're doing. There's bits of merch. There's the gateway to Club Fish, the membership club where we have bonus material popping up every fortnight. It's a really fun place. Check it out. Otherwise, just come back here next week because we will be back with another episode and we will see you then. Goodbye.
Can you do some Foley? I'm just going to walk over there.
Yeah.
That's offensive. He's not that heavy.
And I'm back. I just went to the... I just went to the bookcase because staring me in the face is this book, The Annals of London.
And it's by John Richardson. Wow.
Oh, my God.
By another John Richardson.
He is so good,
isn't
he?
What a coincidence.
This guy's amazing.
He's a polymath.
How does he get time to do the polymath?